Allison Kelly is a PhD student in the history department at the University of Virginia. She received a bachelor's in history from Davidson College in 2015 and a master's in history from the University of Virginia in 2017. Her talk today is adapted from the first two chapters of her dissertation, which analyzed the creation and maintenance of the LDS welfare plan through the end of World War II. Our third panelist is Jeremy Talmadge from the University of Utah, and he is talking about Forever Zion, the church welfare plan, and the underlying dream of a Great Basin Kingdom. Jeremy is a doctoral candidate in history at the University of Utah. He holds master's degrees from the University of Utah and Yale University. His forthcoming dissertation will trace the development of Latter-day Saint thought over the course of the 19th and 20th century. After our speakers, we'll have comments from Thomas Alexander, who is one of the boys of Camelot. He's known for his book, Mormonism in Transition, and he has a forthcoming book, Brigham Young and the Expansion of the Mormon Faith. It's out, so go buy it at one of the book tables.
Will you sign it? I will. Dave asked me if I would sign it. I would be honored to.
$5.
That goes to Dave.
No.
That goes into the Dave Hall Trust Fund. Yeah.
Okay, we're kind of winging this. I kind of expected a podium. Can everyone hear me as I? Okay, if you don't hear me, let me know. I tend to project way loud, way louder than is needed for microphones. And I don't know if I can hold the microphone and read at the same time, so. Okay, so the first decades of the 20th century represented a period of great transition for the Intermountain West. As Thomas Alexander pointed out in his seminal work, Mormonism in Transition, it was also a pivotal time for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. For the purpose of this paper, one of the key developments of that period was the rise of public sector social welfare policies, what scholars refer to as the welfare state. While the general perspective on the part of church members and the public at large is that Mormon charity efforts have always been strictly divided from those of government, the reality is more complex. Indeed, the church, through its organization then primarily responsible for social welfare matters, the Women's Relief Society, supported the growth of public sector programs and worked closely with developing government agencies in the interest of improved public health and social welfare. Here, it would be appropriate to note as a reminder that public sector social welfare programs were next to non-existent at the turn of the 20th century, especially so in Western states like Utah. This even as urbanization and industrialization were creating pressing needs for just such services. At the same time, the federal government, for its part, was completely absent from such affairs anywhere. In addition, while some of the things I will discuss might raise questions in our minds about the separation of church and state, know that most of our current thinking on that subject developed through judicial decisions made in the period after World War II. So we are entering a very different world as we go back to this time period. A key figure in the story of what would become a cooperative relationship between church and state in the interest of social welfare was Amy Brown Lyman, who served as General Secretary of the Relief Society during much of the period discussed here. But Lyman was certainly not alone in her advocacy and was joined by Clarissa Smith Williams, who serves as Relief Society President during most of the 1920s, and others on the Relief Society General Board, such as Jeanette Acord Hyde and others on the board. Priesthood leaders also lent their support, especially Presiding Bishop, Bishop Sylvester Q. Cannon. Determined to improve the lives of families in their communities, these and other like-minded individuals came to adopt a pragmatic approach toward charity work aimed at promoting effective strategies wherever they might encounter them. Functioning as individuals, women of the Relief Society had begun to support local efforts to improve public health in the Salt Lake Valley as early as the 1880s. However, a key milepost for our discussion took place in 1913 when, As an organization, the Relief Society joined in municipal efforts to improve public health by sponsoring, during the hot summer months, a milk depot on Salt Lake's poor west side where unspoiled, unadulterated milk could be obtained. The Relief Society also paid for a public health nurse to provide medical assistance there. Other cooperative endeavors soon followed at the local level. But surprisingly soon, the Relief Society was also advocating for cooperation with some early federal initiatives aimed at improving maternal and child health, such as the Smith-Lever Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1914. And a first for federal involvement in social welfare issues, Smith-Lever allowed land-grant colleges like Utah's State Agricultural College, now USU, to sponsor informal roundups where clinics where up-to-date information on proper health and nutrition could be disseminated. Participation with other federal initiatives focusing on child health followed on the heels of this, including the U.S. Children's Bureau's Baby Week campaign of 1917 and the Bureau's Year of the Child in 1918. In a move along another path in social welfare work, the Relief Society embraced a federal effort coordinated by the American Red Cross to provide aid to servicemen and their families during World War I. This ultimately bore fruit in the creation, under Lyman's direction, of the Relief Society Social Service Department, a modern social work agency serving members of the church. The Relief Society's cooperation with the federal government reached gave significant focused assistance in support of the Federal Maternity and Infancy Act of 1921, better known as the Shepard-Tanner Act. Under its auspices, women in communities throughout the Intermountain West helped organize clinics and education days where expectant mothers and young children could be examined for health problems and referred to local physicians for treatment. All of this brought significant benefits to communities throughout the region, while the Shepard-Tanner work in particular earned recognition from national leaders in the Federal Children's Bureau and linked social welfare agencies. And these activities were born quite simply through a pragmatic desire to bring real improvements in public health to women and their families, and to bring these improvements expediently and effectively. Yet despite the lives saved and the suffering alleviated, none of this found universal support in the Mormon community. This is a key point. There is a tendency to believe that Mormons march in lockstep on public issues, often distort significantly the reality of the situation that is under examination. And this is an area where such is certainly the case. As these efforts progressed, some found in them evidence that the church was moving into inappropriate venues. Susie Young Gates, redoubtable daughter of Brigham Young and former member of the Relief Society General Board, was one of these. Quite conservative in her political views, she was against Shepard-Tanner and voiced concerns shared by other conservatives that it was moving the nation towards acceptance of socialized medicine. General Board member Annie Wells Cannon had her own reservations about some of this work, but her concerns were more nuanced. She had not been averse, for example, to the Relief Society's endorsement of a proposed child labor amendment to the Constitution, but she feared that the organization's intense focus on social work during the 1920s was taking it too far from its spiritual foundations. Lyman, Clarissa Williams, and others on the board, however, heartily embraced these cooperative activities, and for a time, their views prevailed. Meanwhile, because of her intense involvement in a wide range of social welfare activities, Lyman became the church's liaison to social work leaders in the larger community. It should be noted that Lyman's views regarding cooperation with government were based not on any political desire for big government. Since her marriage, she was essentially a lifelong Republican, so that's not her goal. But rather, her desires for cooperation were based on insights born of experience working in the trenches of social work. From the late 1910s to the 1920s, she had developed into a skilled and respected social worker. She had gone on to school dozens of others as professional caseworkers for the Social Relief Society Social Service Department, while preparing more than 1,000 women throughout the West to serve as social work aides in their home states. All of this even as she familiarized the rank and file of the Relief Society with the fundamentals and goals of social work through conference addresses, training sessions, and a series of lessons that appeared in the pages of the Relief Society magazine. In other words, she had mobilized the women of the Relief Society into an effective force aimed at improving public welfare. But as widespread and effective as their efforts were, they only served to convince her that the church could not accomplish its social welfare goals by itself, but needed to embrace a cooperative approach with government if those requiring assistance were to receive adequate aid. This was Lyman's perspective even before the advent of the Great Depression. Nevertheless, as that massive economic downturn descended upon the nation, Lyman and the Relief Society seemed to have been well positioned to spearhead church efforts to address the emerging crisis in cooperation with other interested agencies. However, a number of factors were to limit her ability to mobilize Relief Society women in such an effort. Most importantly was a change in Relief Society leadership. The more activist Clarissa Williams resigned due to declining health and was replaced by Louise Yates Robinson, who was more reserved in manner and more conservative in outlook. Robinson was thus less inclined to continue the society's role in community affairs. And while Lyman served as second counselor in the new presidency, her move away from her previous position as general secretary took her out of the society's day-to-day activities and thus limited her ability to communicate and interact with the membership. Yet even as her ability to shape the agenda of the Relief Society was somewhat diminished, Lyman remained involved in social work matters and continued to be seen as the church's main link to community leaders interested in soliciting the faith's cooperation in welfare work. As the effects of the Great Depression continued to grow, its consequences soon overwhelmed efforts developed locally. By the spring of 1932, social workers across the nation were concluding that only the federal government possessed the ability to address the magnitude of the crisis. Lyman herself so noted this in a meeting of the Relief Society General Board. In January of that year, in an unprecedented expansion of the federal role in social welfare matters, Congress had passed and President Herbert Hoover had signed into law a measure creating the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. This provided $2 billion in the form of loans to stabilize banks, railroads, and parts of the agricultural sector. But because even those resources proved inadequate, just a few months later, in the summer of 1932, an additional $1.5 billion was made available in the form of loans to the states to be used for direct aid to those in desperate circumstances. Like others in Utah, Lyman recognized just how essential these new funds would prove for alleviating the hardships so many were enduring. To ensure that a fair share came to Utah, at the request of public officials, Lyman took the lead in gathering statistics to document Utah's need for assistance. As a member of the Governor's Committee on Emergency Relief, she also assisted in the distribution of these monies when they arrived. And when Utah's counties required more social workers to dispense these same funds, Lyman encouraged her own trained social workers to move to the public sector to fill the void, and then recruited replacements for the Social Service Department from local wards and stakes. This represented a new departure in the type of cooperation taking place between the church through the Relief Society and the government. But Lyman, child as she was of Utah's territorial period, where church and state were intimately connected in the cause of addressing societal problems, quickly recognized the necessity of this latest step. Indeed, in practical terms, it simply made sense for each sector, now including the federal government, to contribute according to its ability in resolving common issues. With the election of Franklin Roosevelt and the emergence of the New Deal, the federal role significantly increased. As this occurred, administrative boundaries of the kind we are familiar with today began to be imposed in order to ensure the orderly dispersal of federal monies. In particular, new regulations required federal funds to be channeled through state welfare departments. So, in April 1933, during Relief Society General Conference, Lyman urged Relief Society women to lobby for the creation of just such an agency in Utah. However, as was common in other parts of the country, Utah's state agency took some time to get up and running. Consequently, the Relief Society Social Service Department itself was temporarily federalized as District 7 of the Salt Lake County Welfare Department, greatly increasing its workloads and responsibility during this period of transition. Meanwhile, Lyman continued her cooperative approach by encouraging the much larger numbers of Relief Society women outside of the department to continue their involvement in public affairs and even to expand it. Speaking in Relief Society General Conference in the fall of 1933, she urged women to advocate for national unemployment insurance and continued her advocacy in subsequent conferences. She also encouraged Relief Society women not only to vote, but to run for public office. And she asked them to study efforts aimed at expanding federal programs, even to the possible creation of a national health care plan. Importantly, as the New Deal efforts continued to take shape, and as federal aid slowly began to assume the lion's share of responsibility for assisting those in need, Lyman thought it vital to maintain engagement with government with the goal of shaping the developing programs. She urged, for example, Relief Society women with a background in public welfare to run for and serve on county welfare boards to help direct the development of welfare policy among the most effective lines possible. Adjusting to this new environment then, the Relief Society was continuing in a decades-long pattern of cooperating with the development of government programs aimed at addressing social welfare needs. All of this from a perspective which viewed government as a tool to be used carefully and with great caution, but one that they saw as solely possessing the power adequate enough to address the hardships that were emerging, the kinds of crises of the kind that they were seeing with the Great Depression. At the same time, Lyman knew that government itself was limited in what it could do. Consequently, there was still a great need for the Relief Society and the church to participate in filling in around the margins with counseling and other means of assistance. Again, Lyman saw government as an ally in a larger cause, not necessarily as a rival. Lyman's generally positive assessment of the New Deal was shared by others in the Relief Society leadership, and of course by Presiding Bishop Sylvester Buchanan. First Counselor in the First Presidency, Anthony Ivins, a Democrat, also seemed to support the efforts of the New Deal. But others held opposite views. Most significantly, after 1933, Second Counselor in the First Presidency, J. Reuben Clark. With his years of political service in Washington, D.C. on behalf of Republican causes, Clark was much more inclined to perceive government as a corruptive agent. Under such circumstances, any interaction with it should be shunned, he felt. Not surprisingly, soon after joining the First Presidency, Clark began to advocate for a very different vision for church welfare, and ultimately, it was his vision that would hold sway. But that is a topic for another paper. So thank you.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming. Looking forward to hearing your questions and comments. On August 27, 1940, First President J. Reuben Clark and David O. McKay, Chairman of the newly minted Welfare Committee, Henry D. Moyle, Presiding Bishop LeGrand Richards, and Relief Society President Amy Brown Lyman came together to dedicate a grain elevator in the heart of Salt Lake City's newly minted Welfare Square. What was then the largest concrete project in the history of Utah, the elevator required 15,000 bags of cement, 640 workers, and 70,151 hours of volunteer labor. It held over 19 million pounds of wheat, or enough to fill 191 railroad cars stretching over a mile long. From the moment that this elevator was erected, church members sensed both its practical and symbolic power. Massive grain stores would alleviate immediate material needs by providing food for thousands of saints, then receiving government relief. However, the Salt Lake Telegram also deemed the elevator a striking monument to the church's adherence to its principles of thrift and industry. As the article suggests, the grain elevator externally signaled the church's renewed commitment to self-sufficiency. I want to focus on this second point by moving conversations about the welfare plan beyond its success or failure as a means of taking saints off government relief. And in doing so, I will address two themes that inform my larger project that I'm working on. In the first half of my talk, I will focus on Amy Brown Lyman, distinguished social worker and influential figure in the Women's Relief Society. I will use Lyman's career and her influence within the Relief Society to dismantle the still pervasive myth that saints have always opposed public relief efforts. I will explain how on that summer day in 1940, when Lyman stood up on the platform with Clark, McKay, Moyle, and Richards, she was not merely relinquishing control over the church's grain stores, she was also publicly conforming her very worldview to the welfare committees. In the second half of this talk, I will analyze the welfare plan's utility as a tightrope between communitarianism and capitalism. I will argue that the welfare plan allowed saints to fully participate in the national economy while internally curbing the effects of capitalism that were antithetical to the church's social ethics. Together, I will use these two themes to demonstrate how the welfare plan was not a natural or inevitable response to the Great Depression. Rather, the welfare plan reflects its architects' desire to square a religious tradition premised on economic equality with their faith in free market capitalism. Present atop the platform of the 1940 grain dedication ceremony was Amy Brown Lyman, the lone woman standing between four high-ranking church officials. As president of the National Women's Relief Society, Lyman had a vested interest in the grain elevator. In 1876, Brigham Young tasked the all-female relief society with wheat storage, and they faithfully assumed that responsibility for 64 years. However, the dedication of the grain elevator exhibited an official end to women's direct control over welfare. Scholars have explained how the welfare plan circumscribed the Relief Society's role in the church welfare system, but I want to explain how the welfare plan invalidated the kind of public-private cooperation women like Amy Brown Lyman championed. The welfare plan was thus more than a system of institutional changes. It ushered in an ideological shift whereby evil public aid was explicitly juxtaposed with rehabilitative church relief. Amy Brown Lyman's social welfare ideology largely centered on two interrelated premises. First, she believed welfare needs had outgrown private charity, but the church still had a definitive, if subsidiary, role to play in community betterment projects. Secondly, Lyman believed social work should be grounded in the latest scientific principles. This is why she made sure the people around her kept abreast with scholarly literature and why she advocated for extensive professional training in social work. Lyman's initial response to the Great Depression reflects these aforementioned ideological premises. As early as 1931, she told a reporter for the Garfield County News that each Relief Society branch would only be able to give an average allowance of 59 cents per needy family per month that year. "I'm sure you will realize at once," she noted, "that the amount received for charity in the Relief Society is far too small for the amount and type of work that needs to be done." This reality did not embarrass Lyman. Rather, she hoped the paltry sum would plainly reveal a need for increased government intervention in welfare work. The magnitude of the Depression and the church's inability to meet saints' needs was the proof that she needed to assert that private institutions were unequipped to handle 20th century problems. Moreover, Lyman was proud of President Roosevelt and his resuscitative efforts. Referring to the Depression, she contended that no government has ever tried harder to meet a situation than has ours. Relief Society women who have been close to the federal relief program, she continued, know that many remarkable things have been accomplished by the government. Further, Lyman insisted that work and service, what she considered to be the twin pillars of Latter-day Saints' social welfare ideology, necessitated supporting the government loyally in the heroic effort it is making in untrodden paths to correct economic and social evils and to restore opportunity and security. The institution of the welfare plan in 1936 sounded the death knell for Lyman's campaign. Saints were still collecting government relief in significant numbers well into the 1940s, but the first presidency made it abundantly clear that the church's work-centered aid was superior to the government dole. In fact, J. Reuben Clark's anti-government rhetoric would become so virulent in the 1940s that it is almost unfathomable that he and Lyman were drawing inspiration from the same theological well. The institution of the welfare plan forced church members to accept a singular conceptualization of church charity, one that excluded Lyman's hope for public-private partnerships that would ameliorate the environmental causes of poverty. To use just one example, juxtaposing Amy Brown Lyman's use of the word cooperation with its use in the Relief Society magazine circa 1940 reflects this ideological shift brought about by the welfare plan. During the 95 years of its existence, the LDS Relief Society has cooperated with many other agencies and organizations which have had for their object human betterment, she described in 1937. Lyman used the word cooperation in the Relief Society magazine to refer to collaborative efforts between public agencies and the Relief Society. Moreover, Lyman typically used cooperation to refer to partnerships that had an explicit, immediate goal in mind. She identified social problems, assessed the means of various organizations, and pursued partnerships that would most effectively and efficiently ameliorate those needs. Hers was a strategy that largely left the heterogeneity of partner organizations intact. Moreover, alleviating human suffering was the chief aim of these partnerships, and she thus had few qualms with the specific religious affiliation or lack thereof of the organizations she worked with. For Lyman, that comparatively capacious term, human betterment, was a sufficient unifying force, making the word cooperation more akin to a coalition. Following the institution of the security plan, the word cooperation exploded into the Relief Society magazine. In this context, cooperation was almost invariably used to describe women's assistance to ward bishops under the dictates of the security plan. Implicitly, cooperation took on a meaning much more similar to obedience. The way it was used in the Relief Society magazine suggested that women who subscribed to Lyman's brand of social welfare needed to reconfigure their beliefs for the sake of internal unity. Men and women alike effusively praised the Relief Society's cooperation to publicly shore up women's support for the plan. In 1937, for example, Relief Society Secretary Cecilia D. Rutter remarked, "It is remarkable how well and how beautifully the sisters have cooperated in contributing toward the church security program. Our chief aim," she concluded, "has been to cooperate with the priesthood and to the very best of our ability, carry out the details and advice and timely instruction which the general board sent to us." Rutter's comments reflect the spirit of female servility at the heart of this brand of cooperation. While cooperation was used to refer to both men's contributions to the welfare plan and women's, it is clear from its countless appearances in the Relief Society magazine in the late 1930s and early 1940s that the word was typically used to encourage women's submission to the dictates of the welfare plan. Equating female submission with cooperation helped shroud the uneven power dynamics at the root of these changes. Moreover, the incessant and extravagant applause women's cooperation elicited from both inside and outside the Relief Society exhibits a comprehensive effort to make Relief Society women amenable to a type of social welfare that was antithetical to many of their worldviews. Whereas the pages of the Relief Society magazine were once lined with odes to Jane Addams and Lyman's explications of legislative efforts that would ameliorate social ills, the institution of the welfare plan equated women's cooperation with canning fruit and knitting quilts. The juxtaposition of a word so commonly seen in both contexts helps demonstrate how the welfare plan established a singular way of conceptualizing church welfare. To be sure, Lyman was far from the only Latter-day Saint to champion government cooperation, but I'm using her career to exhibit the broader reality that there were competing agendas in the immediate wake of the Depression, and in particular, young women in the Relief Society were champions of public-private cooperation. Suggesting that the welfare plan was an inevitable or natural response to the Great Depression because it somehow reflects tried and true Mormon values, therefore asserts a singular interpretation of those values, one that either ignores or discounts saints who, like Lyman, saw public relief efforts as an outgrowth of their religious beliefs. When asked why he did not pursue the modern trend to join with the social agencies in the wake of the Depression, Harold B. Lee responded, "I'm sorry, I have read some scriptures and I believe in following what the Lord said." By explaining the roots of the welfare plan this way, Lee instantly made any claims to an alternative social welfare agenda dissident. Put differently, he suggested that an accurate interpretation of scripture could evidently manifest in only one system, the welfare plan. Now I want to pivot to a discussion of the welfare plan's socio-religious function. The welfare plan has been underappreciated as a critical component of the church's transition from economic communitarianism to capitalism. It facilitated at least a semblance of the economic equality inherent in communitarianism while simultaneously sanctifying individual saints' pursuit of profit in the capitalist economy. Saint's ability to walk this tightrope absolutely enamored outside observers who became obsessed with trying to discern Saint's motivation to volunteer on welfare projects. What journalists found particularly intriguing about the welfare plan was that one could find Saints from different socioeconomic backgrounds standing shoulder to shoulder, getting their hands dirty for someone else's benefit. For example, the Los Angeles Times marveled over the fact that one could find Mormon doctors, dentists, aircraft engineers, chemists, teachers, policemen, and firemen all working together on a Southern California welfare farm on any given Saturday afternoon. As the article suggests, the welfare plan's sacrificial requirements united a religious group that had become beset by class divisions. In 1941, J. Reuben Clark noted, "If we get out into the field alongside some less fortunate brother, if we work shoulder to shoulder with him there, we shall find he is actually a pretty fine fellow and probably a better man than we are when it comes to digging our living out of the soil." Clark's comment evidences a rift that had grown between Saints of different socioeconomic statuses. However, it simultaneously explains how these bonds were being recuperated as Mormon doctors worked alongside blue-collar Saints. Further, Clark's comment even insinuates that these more lucrative professions had sapped Saints' capacity for self-sufficiency. Any feeling of superiority possessed by a lawyer, for example, was abrogated in light of Clark's reminder that office dwellers' hands had grown soft. Moreover, had affluent Saints simply been able to donate money to the welfare plan, they would not have been nearly as invested in their project, and their ability to opt out of physical service would have been yet another marker of their class privilege. As Clark reminded Saints, you cannot get brotherhood just by mere donations of money. We can sit in an office and give $10, then not take a second thought about the purpose of giving and the man to be helped. Welfare projects required all able-bodied Saints to sacrifice their time and comfort for the benefit of their religious community. That church leaders managed to keep doctors, lawyers, and CEOs bent over hoes, pitching manure in mid-20th century America was a remarkable feat that both deeply satisfied them and astounded outside observers. Erasing class divisions, albeit temporarily, was one facet of fostering group cohesion. Not only did Saints need to see themselves as equal, but they also needed a common mission. Stake projects provided a tangible, collaborative enterprise that all Saints could participate in. In only two articles from the Improvement Era, descriptions of stake projects include oneness, unity, working together, shared labor, men bound together as a fraternal unit, quorum consciousness, and the most lyrical, each man aglow with fraternal love and interest in every other member of his quorum. One need not look far to see that welfare projects were not merely a political statement, nor were they purely an attempt to get Saints off government funding. Welfare projects were also intended to recuperate some of the solidarity that had cracked under the weight of economic inequality. One final example, the welfare plan fostered cohesion by placing a renewed premium on fast offerings. Arben O. Clark, a member of the Welfare Committee, explained that this renewal of the practice was intended for Saints to be able to, quote, put yourself in the poor's position by going hungry. However, fast offerings required Saints to experience one element of poverty for one day a month. While the money generated by these fast offerings curbed some of the effects of economic inequality that were clearly antithetical to the church's core values, there were definite limits to this solidarity. For example, those who participated in fasts always had the assurance that their hunger was voluntary and temporary. Yet by convincing Saints that their volunteer hours and fast offerings satisfied a theological command to take care of their own, the welfare plan created a world in which capitalism still seemed not only plausible, but righteous. Economic inequality was morally sanctioned as long as voluntary internal systems were in place to provide for destitute Saints' basic necessities. So bringing these two ostensibly disparate threads together, the denouement of the push for public-private cooperation and the welfare plan's role as a tightrope between capitalism and communitarianism, I want to draw a few preliminary conclusions. First, scholars of 20th century American religious history have repeatedly observed how the Great Depression afforded religious authorities an opportunity to create, experiment, and explore theological avenues that otherwise would have been deemed too radical or disruptive. Once contingency is restored to the creation of the welfare plan by remembering that there were, in fact, competing visions within the church at that time, it becomes clear that the welfare committee capitalized on the opportunity afforded by the Depression to advance an anti-government agenda. Standing as an exemplar of private welfare provided a way to fight against capitalism's tendency to dissolve communal bonds without denouncing capitalism itself. Placing the welfare plan in this context helps lift the church out of historiographical provinciality by making it one among many religious responses to the Depression's extreme conditions. Finally, these two threads both sketch the beginning of the church's ingratiation into the Republican Party. To be sure, Saints still voted for Roosevelt all four terms, but the kind of virulent anti-government rhetoric that undergirded the welfare plan not only discredited Amy Brown Lyman's ideology, it also planted the seeds for an incipient conservative coalition. The welfare plan would come to fulfill a particular longing among political conservatives of various religious stripes who claimed to be nostalgic for a bygone era when religious institutions were responsible for social welfare. Thus, while the architects of the welfare plan suffered immediate defeat in failing to take a significant portion of church members off the government dole, they won the ideological war. By maligning public welfare, they laid the foundation for a particular Mormon brand of conservative politics that would define the church in the second half of the 20th century.
To begin with, we should understand that the attack on the dole was in part misplaced. Both the Reconstruction Finance organization of the Hoover administration and the New Deal promoted work for people in the New Deal through the WPA and the CCCs, as Jeremy has pointed out. And Roosevelt's feeling announced that people should have the dignity of work, and that was part of the reason for the WPA and CCCs. I grew up during the latter part of the Depression and the Second World War, and I always considered odd the emphasis on agriculture. It seemed when we had speakers that came to state conference, they were always giving examples from agriculture, something that I didn't know very well, except when I visited my grandpa's farm up in Mendon. I grew up in the city, and Utah, of course, was one of the leading states to urbanize during this period. As many historians have pointed out, since the late 19th century, church leaders have urged members to promote local business. Jeremy Talmadge argues that the church leaders pushed these efforts even more vigorously during the Depression of the 1930s. And I think he's right about that. President Heber J. Grant went so far as to urge members to buy local products, even if they had to pay more than they would for products that were produced elsewhere. Talmadge points out that according to Henry D. Moyle, one of the primary goals of the church security plan or welfare plan was to establish industries, businesses, and other activities in the community that would convert outside capital to the possibilities which exist within the community. Moyle argued, for the most part, Latter-day Saint communities can be and should be made independent and self-sustaining. And this was one of the goals, as Jeremy pointed out. Talmadge points out correctly that Mike Quinn has shown that the church continued to support failing businesses during the early 20th century. And Talmadge believes that they did so in the hope they could be revived as prosperous local firms. One thing that Talmadge's paper needs correction, and he fixed that in the version that he read here, but not the one I read. Talmadge cites my Utah the Right Place as arguing that unemployment in Utah reached 60%. What I actually wrote was that it was 36%, and in the paper here he corrected that to say that it was 16% higher than the national average. Since the work of Loretta Hefner and others, we've shown that the Relief Society had engaged in welfare work long before the welfare plan of the 1930s. In fact, the church has been involved in assisting those who were in need from its very beginning. Through the work of David Hall, we know of the efforts of Amy Brown Lyman and others to work together with governmental units on the state and federal level to deal with serious problems in the community. During the Progressive Era, the federal government entered into welfare work, a domain which had previously
been the exclusive province of the states. From the Smith-Lieber Act of 1914 through the inauguration of Baby Week and the Children's Bureau in 1918, cooperation with the Red Cross in World War I, and the Shepard-Tanner Act of 1921. Most of the Relief Society leadership supported these efforts. Significantly, however, some prominent members like Susie Young Gates and Amy Wells Cannon opposed them quite strenuously, as David has shown. Significantly, Amy Brown Lehman was a loyal Republican. She supported these efforts largely because of the training she had received in social work and her perception for the need for cooperation between the church in general and governmental units. She served as a representative in the legislature for the Republican Party during the 1920s. She worked first with the Hoover administration's Reconstruction Finance Organization. She urged the development of a state welfare system, and when that failed to materialize rapidly enough, as David has shown us, she supported the federalization of the Relief Society Service Department as District 7 of the Salt Lake County Welfare Department. That, you know, to turn the Relief Society over to Salt Lake County because there weren't enough welfare workers in Salt Lake County. This, of course, increased the workload of the Relief Society. Presiding Bishop Sylvester Q. Cannon and First Presidency First Counselor Anthony W. Ivins supported Lyman's efforts, generally to support the New Deal. Ivins died in 1934, and Cannon was released as presiding bishop in 1938. Beginning in 1933, Second Counselor, and with the death of President Ivins, First Counselor, J. Reuben Clark, who saw in David Hall's words, government as a corruptive agency, turned the church around. On one occasion, he's reported to have complained to President Heber J. Grant that President Ivins was not going to make him into a Democrat. He had a different vision for church welfare. As Allison Kelly has shown, he wanted to try to undermine equality, and that was part of his goal, by having both the rich and the poor to work together on welfare projects. And he, Harold B. Lee, and others wanted to divorce welfare from both the federal and state governments. It's significant that instead of placing the welfare program under the Relief Society and presiding bishop, as previous programs had been, the first presidency placed it under a separate office headed by Harold B. Lee. Allison Kelly introduces an intriguing argument when she wrote, and I quote here, "The welfare plan has been underappreciated as a critical component of the church's transition from economic communitarianism to capitalism. It facilitated at least a semblance of the economic equality inherent in communitarianism while simultaneously sanctifying individual saints' pursuit of profit in the capitalist economy." I would like to see that further developed and more evidence developed on that question. She proceeds to argue men like J. Reuben Clark not only discredited Amy Brown Lyman's ideology, they also planted the seeds for an incipient conservative coalition.
Insipid's fine.
Huh?
Insipid's fine.
I think the word you used was incipient. She believes that by maligning public welfare, they laid the foundation for a particular Mormon brand of political conservatism that would define the church in the second half of the 20th century. I think this is an interesting argument. I'd like to see it more thoroughly worked out and documented if that's possible. I found all three of the papers interesting and enlightening, and I encourage the authors to continue and seek publication for those papers. Thank you.